A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
This podcast contains explicit language.
Know that'll probably be the first thing anyone hears on the podcast. So that happened. This week, the Justice Department lowered the boom on FIFA, the governing body of international soccer, arresting and indicting 9 high-ranking FIFA officials on charges ranging from racketeering, wire fraud, and money laundering. We'll explain why these clapped-out grifters are absolutely worthy targets of a criminal investigation. Meanwhile, is there anyone in the Republican Party not running for president? As the GOP field swells and swells, we'll talk about why it is that so many people who can't possibly win the nomination are going for it anyway. Spoiler alert, the answer is that there's way too much money in politics. Finally, we return to one of our favorite topics, the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal, and why it is that the Obama administration ended up going to the mattresses to get a provision barring countries that engage in slavery from participating in the trade deal out of the bill. I'm Jason Linkins with Huffington Post reporters Zach Carter, Arthur Delaney, Ryan Grimm, and Laura Barone-Lopez. And here's what happened first. Good day, America. Welcome to So That Happened, the Huffington Post DC Bureau podcast about stuff that we watched happen and could do nothing about.
Don't we inevitably affect what we observe?
I suppose that's true. You know, if we move a grain of sand in the Sahara, we've changed humanity.
I mean, we talk to those campaigns and we say, hey, saw you did something.
Yeah, I guess it's true. I guess we have done something about it.
Yeah.
Just maybe not enough, but we're going to try to do some more right now and here. But how's everybody? Obviously, you've given away the game. Arthur Delaney is with us.
Hey.
Say, how's it going, Arthur?
How's it going, Jason?
That's going great. It's going great. And I'm also joined by Zach Carter.
What?
Zach Carter.
Who, me? Zach. I missed last week, so I feel like I'm coming home.
You missed the entire week last week?
No, I had to do a lot of reporting last week, but
right.
I missed the podcast last week, and it made me feel a little bit dead inside.
Well, you know, let's see if we can revive your soul, man.
I've been reborn. Yes. I'm actually being reborn right now. There's fluids everywhere. It's vile.
That's nasty.
I'm glad you're giving our listeners such a mental image. How's everybody been? Good week around? Bad week?
It was a short week, mercifully.
Yeah, Memorial Day.
But the weather, bad weather.
Yeah, it's
too
gotten
hot.
For those of you who don't live in D.C., don't come in the summer because it's awful. It is like being inside a wet rag that's also 110 degrees. We're famous for our heat and humidity. We're also famous for our clapped out political class. But mostly right now is the heat and humidity is bringing everyone down.
Yeah, it's been miserable. My poor dog. My God. We go hiking every morning before work because my dog needs a lot of exercise and is really crazy. And the summers are like great because you just don't have to hike as much. She just gets
too
totally
tired.
Yeah, I mean, I always think there's sort of like a I don't know, Schrodinger's paradox, something here where outside in D.C. it always feels, this time of year, it feels like the inside of a dog's mouth. But when you actually have a really hot dog outside in D.C. at this time, like, does that cause like a dog's mouth inside of a dog's mouth? Is there like a wormhole where I can go back in time as a result of that?
Dogs put their mouths on each other all the time, so it's not like this is a thing that happens. Not a big deal, man.
I think you can go back in time.
Listen, it's summer. The hot weather in D.C. sucks. It's better around August because there didn't used to be air conditioning. Congress was just like, we're out. Bye. We're all going home. And then an aura of goof off descends on the city every August to this day, because I think because Congress has always gone away, and I appreciate that.
Yeah,
that's great.
I don't go on vacation in August because it's a waste. Work is so easy. It's
yeah,
great.
You want to go on vacation right when everyone needs you.
I take a different approach. I hate August. I think August is terrible. And I think that someone somewhere always gets up to some shit in August. And I hate it. So I'm actually going on vacation in August for 13 days. And I will not care about anything in the news while I'm there.
What's going to happen to the podcast, Jason?
We'll find a way to survive.
What?
We'll find a way.
Dad, does this mean you don't?
No, it doesn't mean that. I do like that you somehow created that whole inside a dog's mouth thing. You sort of combined Schrodinger's box and Zeno's paradox into something. If you go halfway inside a dog's mouth and then go halfway further and then go halfway further, do you ever arrive at the end of the dog's mouth?
No, it's just, it becomes 1985 all of a sudden.
Exactly. Mr. is a thing. Was that 1985?
This is bullshit. I mean, we got to talk about politics.
All right, okay. Well, I got to tell you, I am stoked. I am stoked this week something fantastic happened to the world.
Rick Santorum's candidacy.
No. We'll get to that. That's obviously amazing. 14 gentlemen from the Fédération Internationale Football Association were arrested in Switzerland by our Justice Department. I'm so excited.
I have found this story bewildering, so I'm glad you're excited and you can help explain it, because I didn't realize soccer had its own country.
It kind of does.
But I'm glad we're, going to war.
You guys, this is really great news, I think, for the world. So FIFA, a notorious gang of scoundrels. 14 people were arrested, according to the indictment. They were arrested on charges including racketeering, wire fraud, money laundering, and conspiracy. It involved senior soccer officials at FIFA organization, including an executive vice president. It's all taken place right before the FIFA Congress meets to elect their new president. The person who will probably win, even in spite of all of this, is a guy named Sepp Blatter, which sounds like something that happens to your penis when you've put it somewhere bad.
Or your bladder.
Sepp Blatter. I've got a scorching hot case of Sepp Blatter down under.
Oh.
So
it's like a combination, but Sepp is like, it's like Hep C all in one,
right,
one word.
Septic.
So this is going to bring in sports marketing executives from the United States, South America. According to the indictment, these people are accused of paying more than $150 million in bribes, taking kickbacks in exchange for all kinds of nest feathering.
Here's what I don't get.
Yeah.
So they were enriching themselves at the expense of people who do TV contracts. Like, who cares?
They enrich themselves in myriad ways. One of the ways in which they've enriched themselves is that the FIFA's governing council are the people who decide where the World Cup is every year.
Yeah.
And what's supposed to happen is that the countries that want the World Cup are supposed to present their ideas and say, here's how we do the World Cup, blah, blah, blah. And FIFA is supposed to take a studied look at what would be best for the sport and say, you get the World Cup, I think you've got it going on. But what's basically been happening is these countries have made their presentations, but they've also bribed FIFA officials with millions of dollars. Way back when Qatar was awarded, or, well, let's decide, are we going to call it Qatar or Qatar?
Let's call it Qatar. That's the appropriate sort of mainstream.
Okay, that's great. That's great, because later on this podcast, I refer to it as Qatar repeatedly. So let's confuse everyone.
How are you in two time sequences at the
same
time?
Because
I'm
magic.
I'm inside a dog's mouth.
Oh man!
Right. So at the time that Qatar, which we'll call it on this segment, and we'll call it Qatar in a later segment, but at the time they were awarded the World Cup, the governing council, that's normally, I think, 24 people, was down to 22, because two of the members of the organization that decides this stuff were caught trying to sell their vote to journalists pretending to be people who are bribing them. So they're not a bright organization, but they're manifestly corrupt in so many ways, and it's so great that they're being brought to heel.
I want to jump in on Cutter here.
Start being brought to heel. Yeah, let's jump in on Cutter.
Remember, the price of Cutter getting the World Cup is that a country with an absolutely atrocious human rights record has to do all this construction, and they have to get all this infrastructure in place for a major event. And we saw some problems, for instance, with like the Sochi Olympics, like a dozen or so workers died in the process of that. There weren't a lot of great worker protections. It was pretty weak. In Qatar, several hundred, depending on your count, on which nonprofit data you're relying on. In some cases, well over 1,000 people who have been trafficked to Qatar to work on the World Cup stuff have died since they were awarded. Over 1,000.
1,200.
Yeah, and Qatar, just to put this in, we're going to talk about this later, to put that in perspective, Qatar's not even the worst category of, like, human trafficking violator. And so they're like, one step above the worst. And so it's
which
nice
is crazy to me, because Malaysia, the country that's wrapped up in the TPP controversy, they're considered a tier three.
So Qatar is a tier two.
Yeah.
Tier two watch list. So they might drop down to tier three any minute now. Currently, Malaysia is worse, and we are trying to pursue a trade deal that doesn't force Malaysia to do anything about that. That's now, a side note, though.
But Qatar is a place of booming construction all the time, regardless.
Fantastically rich nation, oil-rich nation.
So it's, you know, to what degree would, you know, people are going to be dying and human trafficked, whether FIFA is doing this there or
but
not.
But they wouldn't be building 12 stadiums in Qatar if it weren't for this bizarre decision to give them the World Cup. And I want to say, you know, and I've already heard from people about this that have asked, well, FIFA, so what? Wouldn't it be great if we nailed big bankers? Wouldn't it be great if we nailed big corporations? And look, I understand that the sort of like palace intrigue in FIFA, the sort of ins and outs, the kind of like Downton Abbey-esque like narrative of corruption that goes on behind closed doors seems silly to a lot of people, because it's about soccer. And it's about a sport that most Americans don't care about and is still just sort of seemingly a frivolous thing. But I want to tell you people, these are definitely worthy, the going after these people at FIFA, very worthy goal. Qatar is a nation that has no real soccer tradition, and it is 120 degrees Fahrenheit during the summer, which is when the World Cup is normally held. Obviously, it would be held at some other time, but it's still way too hot to play soccer. They have to build a bunch of stadiums. They don't have a bunch of soccer stadiums, which is crazy. A lot of very top architectural firms have been called in to design these elaborate stadiums. They look from the future. They're gorgeous. But as is tradition in Qatar, all the people who do the construction work are essentially slaves. I mean, they're basically slaves. And this is the kind of worst. It's funny to now know that Malaysia's worse, because if you think about what's happening in Qatar, it's crazy. These people are trafficked from Nepal and India, primarily. They're from other countries too, but they're primarily from Nepal and India. And they are brought to Qatar, and their passports are taken away. And they are locked in to grueling, unbelievably grueling and painful construction work. They live shitty, they eat crappy food, and they still have to pay off various people, including the people who trafficked them there in the first place.
It's basically like indentured servitude.
Yes.
Indefinite, though.
They can't leave the country to go home. Like, they can't be – there's never a situation where a slave says, yeah, you know what, fuck this, I'm going back to Nepal. Nah, because they've the people who have hired them have taken their passport, taken their papers. They can't leave. There have been two devastating earthquakes in Nepal in the past month. And people, Nepalese workers in Qatar have tried to get back home to their families. Qatar won't let them leave. The people in charge of this won't let them leave. Journalists have gone to Qatar to report on this. The government has stepped in and arrested them. They held a couple, I believe, New York Times reporters. I'm probably wrong on that. I will check. They recently put two reporters who were covering the story in prison for a period of time. Wouldn't let them out of prison. Didn't charge them with anything. In fact, when the time came for them to rejoin the junket that they were supposed to be on in the first place, they just let them go and rejoin the junket.
Huh.
It's crazy. 1,200 people, of these slaves, have died. That is insane.
And it's just in a couple years. I mean,
yes.
This is not like over the course of 20 or 30 years.
No, yeah. This is going to happen in 2022. We're projected. The projected deaths, about 4,000. So think about it. Is it worth it to have a World Cup where the cost is essentially 1.5 September 11th? That's crazy to think about.
And to people who are thinking the FIFA scandal is not that big a deal, like why don't we crack down on big banks, this sort of thing. I mean, FIFA makes a ton of money. This is a white collar crime scandal. This is something where thousands of people are dying, other people are living like shit, basically, so that people at FIFA can get really, really filthy rich. That is actually an extreme version of what went on in the financial crisis, right?
Yeah,
where a lot of people's lives were ruined so that other people could try to get really rich.
We're talking about people cut from the same cloth. They do not have the minds to conceive of, you know, an epic, you know, they don't have the minds to do the quantitative shit that you do on Wall Street, credit default swaps. That's it. But they do have the souls.
A lot of people on Wall Street don't have the minds.
You're right. You're right. But they hire the people to do. But they do have the same type of souls, and they manipulate money in ways that are maybe a lot less sophisticated than a Wall Street criminal, but nevertheless still very devastating. And you know, I think that probably most people on Wall Street can at least walk down the street feeling that they were part of a productive economy.
They were not facilitating human trafficking.
Right.
And these guys were living fabulously wealthy lives.
Yeah. I mean, they're all...
They're the big anecdote. Everyone was talking about the one guy had $6,000 apartment for his cats.
Yes. Yes. They're a bunch of ridiculous people. And they're vice-ridden blackguards, basically. What's funny is that international sports right now, you know, one of the things I said after this is, of course, what sports, professional sports organization or amateur sports organization or profitable sports organization would you not want to see, like, hung by the heels in the town square right now? And I think the only one that anyone came up with that doesn't deserve to be punished is the Special Olympics. We're all agreed the Special Olympics, those are great guys.
It's pretty good, yeah.
Yeah, they're good people. Leave them alone. But the IOC, is the International Olympic Committee, is just as bad as FIFA.
Terrible.
And here at home, we have the NC2A, completely corrupt.
But which is dependent on the NBA to function the way it does.
Yeah, we have the NFL, which has been shit. We're not too far removed from when Major League Baseball was making headlines for all the wrong reasons.
What about the NHL? Does anything bad happen? Are they bad?
I think that most people don't care about the NHL.
They got the concussions.
Yeah.
You want to hate them. You hate them for that.
They have a concussion situation going on.
I am not going to put these sports organizations in the league as the FIFA and its evil fiefdom.
Well,
as you've described it.
Here's the thing. You should absolutely put the IOC there because there's a lot of crossover between the type of people and actually some of the same people between FIFA and the IOC. They're all corrupt, martinets from the international community. The IOC is having a really hard time now with the Olympics. There's a Winter Olympics that's supposed to happen let me find out what year. It's not the next Winter Olympics, but it's the one that's supposed to happen, I think, around the same time as the World Cup we're talking about.
In the early 2020s.
Yes, and they don't have a bidder for it. They they started with a bunch of bids from the kind of nations that you'd expect to want.
They were trying to get it here in Washington.
They were, which is crazy.
Which was like it was not even close to a grassroots thing. It was sports team owners and big shots.
Yeah, yeah. So Sweden put in a bid, Norway put in a bid, Switzerland put in a bid. I think Germany did too. And what's happened is. A bunch of nations who originally put in bids held plebiscites, and people said, you know what, we don't want the Olympics here in our country. We don't want it here. Norway, Oslo, which put in a bid, they're supposed to have a referendum about it sometime, I believe, this year, and it's likely it'll go down there too. Lviv, the Ukraine, put in a bid. They're obviously not going to have a Winter Olympics. They are currently being invaded by Russia. So they're not going to have an Olympics. Russia might have a fucking Olympics in Ukraine, but Ukraine's not going to have an Olympics. And so the two bids that are left are China and Kazakhstan.
China just had a big Olympics.
Yes, they had a Summer Olympics.
But
you see what's happening here. Yeah. You see what's happening here and how far over the skis FIFA and the IOC have gotten. It is not going to be possible for them to stage these events in democracies anymore. It's not going to be possible for them to stage these events in nations where enough people are like, you know what? Fuck, we're not going to hire slaves to build these stadiums. We're not going to build these stadiums in the first place. We're not going to fall for this fucking boondoggle. The only places left on Earth that could possibly stage the Olympics are autocratic regimes and petrochemical dictatorships, because those are the only type of places where, like, literally an autocrat can command people to do this crazy shit with their economy and then, like, 2 weeks be like, well, we can dispose of all that. It's this is like the beginning of what I think could be a tipping point for these scoundrels who run international sports syndicates.
That's good. And yet people's understanding of this story is pretty superficial. It's jokes about, yeah, we don't like soccer. We're getting them.
Yeah, I mean,
those jokes are funny.
They are funny.
People at FIFA deflate the soccer balls in the World Cup? What happened?
We like the one that was like when the FIFA officials were arrested, they all fell down and pretend to be hurt.
These are legitimately funny jokes.
It was a good joke. Yeah, yeah. It is. Just, you know what? It's just soccer, and it's weird. You know, the UEFA, the European Football Association, that runs the Champions League, and they run this very, very good soccer system in Europe. They're really angry about what's happening in FIFA, and they've talked about boycotting the upcoming elections and perhaps pulling out of FIFA altogether, which sounds amazing because they are probably by far the most respected international soccer league in the world. But the other football associations still back FIFA. A lot of them still back Sepp Blatter. Russia, of course. In their current rush to, like, you know, pal around with anybody who proves to be a complete blackguard, have like issued a warning to the United States to not mess with FIFA, which I'm sure we won't listen to. But it does feel like we're at perhaps some kind of tipping point where hopefully we bring some of these organizations to heel, because when they're not being just manifestly corrupt, they're still selling a false story to nations about what good their sporting event will do for their country. And the thing that kind of sickens me on this is that I think that as the story develops, I worry that, like, an onus is going to be placed on the players to boycott these events or the fans to stop watching these events. No.
That's too tough.
The onus should be on organizations like Coca-Cola, Budweiser, major sports sponsors, to say, we're not putting up with this shit anymore. And they do have leverage. In Brazil, when FIFA wanted to change the law that banned the sale of alcohol in sports stadiums, Budweiser muscled in and used FIFA to get them to change that law. So the sponsors have leverage.
Now, wait a minute. When Budweiser protested, you know, questioned its sponsorship of the NFL publicly, when there was all that domestic violence stuff, that was a real farce. Because who is involved in, who is responsible for more domestic violence? The sports organization or the alcohol company?
Good point. Good point.
The choice is clear.
Of course it was a farce. But this is an opportunity for our big corporate brands to wake up and understand that they can't look smilingly on what's happening in places like Qatar, and they can't look smilingly on organizations like FIFA and what they're doing to the world and what they're doing to people.
Well, fortunately, corporate leaders in the United States have a long and storied recent history
of
doing the right
people.
Thing because it's cool.
Right. Well, just remember,
I think everything's going to get better. I'm with Jason.
Just remember, I mean, I don't know if things are going to get better, but take names. Take names along the way is what I'm saying. Hey there, listener of this podcast. I've got a quick little thing I'd love to chat with you about. Are you a regular So That Happened listener? Well, let us know. Send me an electronic communication with your electronic communicating devices at sothathappened@huffingtonpost.com. Tell us what you think of the show, what we're messing up, and who you'd like to hear more from or more about. Okay, back to the program. All right, so we're moving on now to a topic perhaps more frivolous. We don't often talk about 2016 here on this podcast. We know that there's going to come a time where it's going to be very important to talk about 2016. We resist it.
That time will probably be when, Jason?
October 2016.
No, that's right. 2016. It's in the name.
Yeah, it's in the name.
I think you're wrong. I think the future is now. And I know you actually secretly think that, too. I think we're in 2016.
You're accusing me of being ironic in my dislike for the way our elections start.
Are you inside a dog's mouth right now?
I think it's a meta irony. And we're all inside the dog's mouth.
I trade election systems with Britain in a heartbeat.
You know who's in the dog's
shit
mouth?
Shit takes a month. Genuinely exciting results in the UK election. People couldn't predict it. Not in the United States.
I'm not going to start drinking tea and doing British politics. I'm a 2016 man.
All right.
But you asked who's inside a dog's mouth, and I wanted to know. I wanted you to follow that one.
I thought we already established that we all are and that we're simultaneously in multiple points in time here and in the future.
Okay. Yeah, that's correct.
Okay, so...
Rick Santorum announced his candidacy this week.
Which feels kind of dog's mouthy.
It feels
real dog's mouthy.
It's simultaneously about the past and the future.
Yes, and it's about... A guy who, I'll give Rick Santorum his due. He came closer to the nomination last time than anyone expected, and I felt at the time I was real wrong on Rick Santorum in 2012. I said he's obviously a guy Republicans like, but few people will vote for, because for a long time he stuck around in that 1% range, couldn't get a pop. Then he started debating, and at debates he proved to be somewhat of a pugilist. Over the course of the 500 debates that happened, he moved from the far off fringes to the center. And I feel like if he had gotten a little bit of support from the sort of natural donor networks that might have supported him, he may have pulled off a win.
But I disagree. I think he was one of several people who were alternatives to Mitt Romney at different times.
No, are you kidding me? You're comparing him to like Herman Cain, Newt Gingrich, these people who like pop for a minute?
Yeah.
Yeah. They just all popped for a minute, and he was the last man standing.
He was the last one. That's it.
And he got to stick around because they all had their little billionaire.
He won Iowa, you know. Rick Santorum won the Iowa caucus.
That's true. He did. But he also did. One of the things that's funny about money in politics is like when we talk about 2016 this cycle, it's like, well, Jeb Bush and Scott Walker, they've got all the big money locked up. All these guys are going to have their own little pet billionaire.
Yeah, they do. That's absolutely right.
And that's, you know, when you're talking billions of dollars that can be thrown into a race, it doesn't necessarily matter whether you've got the establishment money locked up or not. In terms of just actually maintaining the finances necessary to keep the campaign up. And we saw that last time with Rick Santorum. I mean, Foster Freeze was taking care of him. You know, saying weird things about birth control the whole time.
He said birth control that women should use is putting Tylenol between their knees.
Right. I had to
have that explained to me.
When I'm talking about the
real
support,
guy-ism.
When I'm talking about the support they never showed for Rick Santorum, I'm talking about the evangelical networks who on multiple occasions profess themselves to be coming close to supporting Rick Santorum, and then they never came through.
Well, look, here's why he's an interesting candidate this time around, I think. He is one of the few candidates in the Republican Party who will actually talk about community a little bit.
And manufacturing,
yeah. And so he can actually, while I think the economic policies that he has supported in the past are totally unhinged from this rhetoric for the most part. Everybody else in the party talking about basically the right to be rich and not have anybody tax you is not actually what Rick Santorum talks about. He talks about building communities, and he has a little bit of a mixed record to some extent on economic policies. He hasn't been just a hardline cut taxes for rich people across the board guy and let everybody else sort of sink or swim as they please.
Right, but
he's
neither...
supported the minimum wage, for example, and also in some situations unions.
Yeah, and he's backed. I mean, he's from Pennsylvania.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Pennsylvania. So, I mean, there's a strong union.
Outside of the fact that he's from Pennsylvania, everything you've described about Rick Santorum is an aspect that can be attributed. And some of the things that we haven't yet really fully ascribed Rick Santorum, we can put on Mike Huckabee, same way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, talks about the same things, has the same evangelical background. Well, I mean, sorry, apologize. Rick Santorum's Catholic. Mike Huckabee is not Catholic. Mm-hmm. But if you don't know that, their rhetoric on religion is more or less the same.
But Rick Santorum works this working class brand harder than anyone else. And that's what he was doing in his Wednesday announcement.
That's true.
He was saying, what about those politicians who for years, you know, what have they done? Which is, you know, it's really a forward-looking statement because he was in the U.S. Senate for about almost 15 years, so
and in the House before that, right?
Yep. Yeah. He's, and I tell you, he'll give a fight, and he'll be able to do it with a lot less money. But I just feel like this Republican field is so crowded. There's already a shit ton of people in this field. There's more. George Pataki's announced today. George Pataki. Great. I mean, man.
Like 1996.
It's like we needed a Jim Gilmore in the race. Like a guy who, like, years later we're like, oh, wow, he ran? It's like a trivia question. Like, yeah. Thanks, George Pataki.
It'll be a hard trivia question.
I would love to meet George Pataki's friends because, like, they are so optimistic. They're always like, you could be president, George
Pataki.
Well,
now, wait a minute. Here's something that I've wondered about for a long time.
Okay.
To some extent, this is how some of these people make a living. Maybe not the individual candidates themselves, though. I do think for some people, it's like a lifestyle.
Coyly presenting themselves as presidential candidates. And
right. I mean, it makes you a potential media personality.
Yep.
Almost indefinitely.
Yep. Your speaker fees go way up.
You're surrounded by people telling you you're good for a long time. And those people themselves,
I would say,
you know, they say that they're good and they make a living. There's a racket going on.
Definitely.
And so George Pataki obviously doesn't think he's going to win, but he's like, you know what? I have calculated that entering the Republican primary business will be advantageous to me, and I don't think that necessarily has anything to do with holding elective office.
It's actually very impressive. On that level, that George Pataki has arrived at that point, because it is kind of a privileged perch in American politics to be able to essentially be a permanent fixture in the campaign thoughts of a nation. And there are a bunch of attendant benefits that accrue to that. There's just the networking alone connects you to so many different financial opportunities that you wouldn't have otherwise had if you'd just been like a half decent governor of New York and retired into private life doing something else. It's interesting that George Pataki has like tapped in, but he'll never be president, never in a million years. I mean,
you know, this links up with a lot of other sort of weird D.C. corrupty things that happen. Like there's this whole like weird conference circuit in D.C. where organizations hold these big brouhahas somewhere in D.C. and they get a couple of like second tier politicians to come and talk. And
yep.
And everybody's supposed to go, and they pay hundreds of dollars to go and show up. And these guys show up. Newt Gingrich was – I was at a banking conference a couple of years ago, and Newt Gingrich showed up. As like the keynote speaker one day, and I was like, "What the hell is Newt Gingrich going to have to say about like banking? It's going to matter to these like, you know, Midwestern banking dudes who just like showed up in D.C. for
What did he have to say to them?
He just said a bunch of just sort of bland deregulatory blather. He was like, you know, the government would never invent Uber. You know, it's you know how long regulations are? They're so long. They're like a million pages long.
Yeah. Here's what's amazing about this as an enterprise. Last time I checked, which was within the past 2 months, Newt Gingrich's 2012 campaign still owed like at least a couple $1 million to the people who printed their pamphlets.
Yeah, he
and
went,
set up their curtain rods.
The one only mistake he made in his presidential run was that he went in debt.
Rick Santorum is still in debt from 2012, and within the last year or so was renting out his mailing list from that election to try to retire some of that debt. That is bizarre to me that is allowed. You know, people are just sort of it's like ghost written op eds. Like everyone's just okay with it.
So what is this? What is the back to the politics of this? The more electoral side of things. There are like 9 Republicans in the race right now. Is a big crowded primary field something that the Republican Party has a vested interest in pursuing this time around?
See, I thought not. When I read the Growth and Opportunity Project, which is what people call the RNC autopsy, the sort of like what went wrong in 2012, there seemed to be no one really came right out and said it, because it's not a thing you come right out and say that we need fewer people to run. But it was sort of implied that the campaign season, the primary season, went on too long. There are too many candidates who caught fire too quickly and burned out, wasted everyone's time, and there were way too many debates, too many opportunities for someone to say something dumb that would stick with them. And, of course, one of the ways you can, you know, elicit dumb things people say is to have a bunch of opponents all desperate to claw their way up from 5% to 10%. And so I don't think that they had a vested interest in this. And I believe what the RNC really thought was going to happen was that someone would enter the primary early, not enter the primary, just announce, or a couple people, and they would accrue big elite backing, mm-hmm. and it would scare a lot of these people away from running. But like you just pointed out, everyone's got a pet billionaire now. Everyone has someone who will fund some kind of campaign. And so we're back in it. We're back in it with a situation where they may not be able to put everyone running for president on the debate stage at the same time. But it just shows, I think that We're entering a world where like the traditional ways of campaigning or even running a presidential election are falling by the wayside. And I think Citizens United plays a huge role in that. I feel like party elites are not as important anymore. The RNC punted on solving this debate problem themselves. They don't exert a lot of influence. The fact that some guy in Washington thinks Scott Walker would make a great president doesn't matter that much anymore, because he's got billions of dollars at his back. Doesn't matter. Doesn't matter what you think. You know, you get on board with me, I take you somewhere. You don't put me in the mix anymore. It's different. And you see more and more campaigns setting themselves up where the person who would have in the past been the campaign manager, okay, the sort of like the face of the campaign behind the scenes, those guys aren't even working on campaigns anymore. They're going to be running super PACs. Bush's campaign, Mike Murphy, who you normally would hire to be a campaign manager, he's going to run the Right to Rest super PAC, which means
he's going to get rich.
He's going to get super rich, amazingly rich, because the It's crazy how much money is going to change hands and how much percentage he's going to get from that. The campaign is not going to get a lot of money. Jeb Bush has said that most of his operation is going to be run by the super PAC. They'll make decisions. They'll take money. They'll cut ads. And the funny thing about it is, of course, that a lot of people still pretend that candidates and super PACs never communicate with each other. That is, of course, bullshit. And it could not be more apparent that it's bullshit, because you would just not let a rogue organization do what it want, do run your campaign for you without contacting you.
I love the 2016. I love it.
Well, yeah.
What about the Democrats, though? Because the Democrats have like the opposite problem. I don't buy – a few weeks ago there was like a whole bunch of stories that were coming out saying, oh, the Democrats have a bench problem. The Republicans have such a deep bench. Look at all these good candidates. I think the Republican candidates are mostly deeply, deeply flawed and hugely problematic. But the Democrats have one candidate who is deeply flawed and usually problematic. And that's basically it.
That's right. Well, you know what?
I mean, people are writing up Bernie Sanders. He has declared he is running as a for the Democratic nomination. So technically, there are two candidates, but. Everybody cleared out. The thing that the RNC elites wanted Republicans to do happened on the Democratic side without anybody asking for it.
They got it. It's weird. You know, one of the things I'll point out is that when we talk about we can overrate the Republicans' quote unquote deep bench. I mean, it's not necessarily a bench anymore if everyone on that bench wants to play quarterback. Okay, that's a little crazy. The real problem, I think, when it comes to the parties and their benches is that the GOP does have a deeper bench, and it's because they invest more in getting local officials elected to state legislatures, county boards, that kind of thing. And so there's a chum coming up the mix of Republican legislators getting promoted through the system. Democrats have, like, really – they seem to only be about the big show, the presidential election, anymore. In a lot of ways, it's because there are fundamentals that inhibit them from getting representatives elected to the House. But there, you don't hear a lot about the efforts being made to, like, fundamentally build that foundation in state and local races.
Well, but there's also the money issue, though. I mean, why is it?
I think everyone's got money.
Why is it that no billionaire has been like, you know what? I really like this congressman from Nevada or something. Just run. I'll give you $20 million. Just do it. I mean, you don't see that happening. You see all that money going to Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, I think the billionaires will start to figure this out, and I think some already have. I think that what'll end up happening is that billionaires will understand that the presidential election, well, you got to kind of play in it. It's not the place to play. The place to play, there's so many offices that you can run for practically unopposed, and you won't have to spend $1 billion just to get some county board guy out there who will pass everything that you're interested in.
And, you know, Mitch McConnell, this is one of the sources of his power. I mean, he's not just a member of he's not just the Senate Majority Leader. For years and years and years in Kentucky, he has bankrolled just House legislature, the state legislature campaigns. You know, just $1,000, whatever. And if that person ever goes anywhere in Kentucky politics, they know, you know, Mitch McConnell's the guy who gave me my start, and I owe him when I get someplace.
That's right. That's right.
And it's, you know, he's had a lot of success with that, and also done a lot of other crazy stuff on money and politics, like directly launching lawsuits that eventually lead to Citizens United and such. But that is another story.
Right. I tell you what, it's always interesting to me. We started talking about anything in 2016. Eventually, we're kind of led back to the money, which is where all the action is.
Politics is basically money and violence.
Yeah, just wait till we figure out who mistreated their dog.
There's the violence for you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks, guys. Keep up with Zach and Arthur on Twitter. Arthur is at Arthur Delaney HP,
yes.
ArthurDelaneyHP. The HP stands for hip person, and you should follow him. And you can follow
Pancake.
You can follow Zach Carter at Zach D. Carter, which is ZachDCarter.
H as in hammer.
Yeah, he brings the hammer. And you can follow me at Deceiver.
DCEIVER.
EIEIO. Thanks, guys. Okay, so we're back, and now I'm joined by two of my favorite people.
You say that to all of the
I do say people. That to all of them, because I don't ever have shitheads on the show. Not yet, anyway. One day maybe. But welcome, Laura Barone-Lopez.
Thank you.
And welcome the Huffington Post Bureau Chief, Ryan Grimm.
Thank you.
So, once again, we're going back to the well that is the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal, of which you guys have written quite a bit about, but specifically what we want to talk about today is slavery, and the way in which it was last week when voting came down to the wire. I think on Friday.
Yes, 10 p.m. on Friday.
Yeah,
night.
It was fun for all you guys covering it.
Yes, I was there in the Capitol, losing my mind.
I was on my couch.
I was at I don't cover trade, so I was at home having a martini or something. I don't know. Watching
nice.
Grace Helbig show. and so the sticking point was over human trafficking, specifically in Malaysia. Mm-hmm. And the Democrats, the people who voted or those that have been opposing TPP, wanted to take a stand on this issue and say slavery, it's not cool. It's like teenage suicide. Don't do it. Yeah. But the White House had a differing opinion.
That's right.
About slavery.
Because it has to do with slavery in Malaysia. And Malaysia is one of the 11 countries with the U.S. in the TPP. And so Friday night when they were voting to give Obama fast-track authority to push these deals through Congress, a provision snuck in that had been put in by Senator Bob Menendez and was supposed to be modified. But he had put it in basically saying that any country like Malaysia, who's a tier three, which is the worst designation you can have.
Who does the designation?
State Department.
Okay. And tier three means that
tier three means they're the worst human trafficking country. It's like the lowest rank that you can have.
Is like North Korea, tier Saudi two, Arabia. Like you,
is tier Those two are. Like you dabble in it?
It's you're that you're probably taking some action towards it or working your way to get a better handle on it, whereas I don't think, you know, Malaysia, in the State Department report, they say things like, you know, certain cases will be reported, and yet they go uninvestigated. And
right. Tier three is you're bad, and you're not even pretending mm-hmm. to do anything about it.
Okay, yeah. So this is these are the worst of the worst. Mm-hmm. So why on earth would it be controversial to take a stand against slavery, especially the sort of like human trafficking that puts you in the same league as North Korea or Saudi Arabia?
Well, you can't just kick Malaysia out of the deal if you're President Obama, because this whole thing is about global power. And Malaysia controls the Strait of Malacca, which is one of just a handful of what are known as choke points around the globe. The one that we're most familiar with is the Panama Canal, you know, and that drove our foreign policy for half a century. So if you can imagine the Strait of Malacca, it's basically a Panama Canal over, you know, that connects the Indian Ocean and the Pacific Ocean. Something like 85% of China's imported oil flows through this strait. Malaysia controls it. So therefore, they get to do whatever they want. It's as if the if this were Game of Thrones, as if the ambassador from Slaver's Bay showed up and said, look, this is what we demand.
And it's a shortcut, too.
Right.
Like helps.
Yeah, sure. You could go around the Panama Canal. You know, nobody's stopping you from not going around South
Surely
America.
Surely it's less expensive to go around Malaysia, though.
It's less expensive, but, you know, shipping and global commerce, you know, this is a game of pennies.
Right. The margins are.
So if you're spending an extra couple weeks out at sea, you know, then you're not going to be able to compete against the people who are running right through the Strait of Malacca. So what this also does is help explain why the president, you know, wants this deal so badly, even mm-hmm. though all of his friends say it's going to hurt American workers. And he hasn't been able to come up with a convincing argument, because I don't think he wants to make the foreign policy argument, because I don't think he thinks that would really resonate with people. But this is truly about geopolitics.
I had on good authority that Barack Obama was like anti-colonialist Kenyan, right? So this is kind of odd.
I never understood why.
Maybe not good authority.
Why being an anti-colonialist is a knock on an American.
Right, seriously.
Yeah. That doesn't, I mean, what are they? Pro-colonialists? We were a colony. We threw it off.
Yeah.
I hope if you have Newt or somebody on who makes that line about him being an anti-colonialist, you ask him, because I don't quite get why is that a bad thing?
Well, if I have Newt on, you know, I'll say he's one of my favorite people, because I'm a slut for calling my favorite people, apparently. But do we have to just sort of sit back and accept this? In order to make this deal happen and to project power geopolitically, which is, I guess, something that Obama wants to do quietly but not make a big stink about, do we have to necessarily accept that Malaysia is going to continue these practices? What if keeping them out of the TPP arrangement could be temporarily predicated on cleaning up their act?
You know, the president likes to do those kinds of, you know, black or white types of choices. These people, they don't want to trade anything with anybody ever. Me, you know, I'm in the middle. And it's not actually a decision of whether or not they're kicked out or not, or whether or not they go you know, China or us, because in fact Malaysia is very close to China. You know,
do you like, mean geographically?
Yeah,
or geopolitically.
Geographically, yeah. They're like a nine iron away. You know, okay. they can see China the way that Palin can see Russia. So if Malaysia wanted better relations with China over the last couple thousand or couple hundred or couple decades, they could have them, but they don't. The Chinese are not a friendly country to ally yourself with, because they, you know, they're kind of bullies in the region. We are a much more sophisticated empire.
Right.
You know, we don't make a lot of demands. We come in. We want to put our ships here.
So it would be bullying to say stop the practice of human trafficking, Malaysia.
Right. We're not going to. And look, we'll say, look, you
we're
need
just
to
going
take
with
some
the flow,
time.
Man.
You know, you need to take some steps and like at least pretend like you're dealing with this. But we're not going to invade them. You know, we're not going to build an island fortress right next to Malaysia. We're just going to plant our ships there and let our corporate vessels go through. That's all we want.
But we do have military assets Maybe. In that area, though, don't we?
We have them now tacitly, and this would kind of allow them to stay in a more permanent and official kind of way. But the point is that Malaysia would prefer to have a closer relationship with the United States than it would to China. Therefore, we have leverage. So if we wanted to say, well, you know, you've seen the Obama administration negotiate with Congress. You know, they often have leverage that they don't seem to think that they have and don't use. I don't know why.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
And they're on the clock. They're going into, well, they didn't have the second round of talks that they were supposed to, but he's on a tight schedule, and I think that he doesn't want to create more problems than he already has with getting fast track through Congress. So it's probably just because they're trying to focus on making sure that he gets fast track, because that's going to be a heavy lift in the House. It's not going to be easy at all. And it's, you know, paying or bringing attention to something that he kind of doesn't want to bring attention to would cause even more problems.
Yeah. Laura's point about the clock is key, you know, and it gets to how ungovernable this country is becoming. You know, we're headed into the summer recess, and after that, you've got the presidential campaign.
Yeah.
So, you know, he feels like if he can get this through, he's got to get it through soon. And, you know, if we had some type of autocratic system, you know, he would do this at his leisure and get the best deal he could for the United States. But, you know, he's term limited out next year, so he's going to. And he wants his name on this rather than Hillary Clinton's.
Exactly.
Well, I hate to bring attention to the problem a little bit more, but it was reported this week that in the border village of Wang Kilan in Malaysia, they stumbled upon mass graves that are now being exhumed by the Malaysian government. They're part of what appear to be a base of operations for human traffickers. And apparently they went completely unnoticed until people apparently got out of these camps and like went into the local towns begging for food. And now there are gigantic holes in the ground filled with bodies that have all obviously died of some nefarious reason. I mean, this is this week. This is mm-hmm. this coming out. You know, there couldn't be more. You can't put a more tragic face on what's going on in Malaysia. Can we actually like move into a world where we're sort of tacitly approving of this sort of thing?
That's the world that we live in now. Mm-hmm. And if our story was actually picked up in Malaysia, and the government responded to it and said, we're not worried about getting kicked out of the TPP. We've been assured by the United States mm-hmm. That the as long as we take quote unquote concrete steps towards reducing this problem, that you know, tier three violators can remain in the TPP. Concrete steps, what does that mean?
That could be
a speech, it could be a press release, it could be it's anything that the State Department affirms is a concrete step. And the State Department has every incentive to affirm that they're taking concrete steps.
So that
doesn't have to lead to any actual measurable progress.
That's what the watered-down language would be, too, that if they say that they're going to take concrete steps and the State Department gives the go-ahead to Congress, then they're okay to be in the deal. So that's what the modified version of this language that snuck in the Senate bill the House is hoping to change it to be along those lines.
Performing autopsies on the bodies that they exhumed and publicly saying that they're opening an investigation into who did this could plausibly be considered a concrete step, sure. I mean, if you're the State Department and your job is to... That would be quite a move for the State Department to say, oh, you know what, actually, we're not going to certify any of this. TPP's blown up. I mean, that's just not going to happen.
So this thing's going to... Do you reckon this thing's going to go down and we're just going to have to, like, live with the fact that...
Well, it's interesting. So...
Nice cynicism.
So the next fight... Yeah. I mean, the next fight is in the House of Representatives.
Right.
Which is much closer to the people than the Senate is. They couldn't get airstrikes
closer
on Syria.
Closer to the enslaved people?
Right. Well, the American people who don't like these trade deals. You know, right. They don't.
Yeah, that's true.
They tend to push these through during lame ducks. And
that's what's going to make it harder.
They only got, if they didn't have earmarks, they wouldn't have gotten NAFTA through. So you have a ton of Tea Partiers against this in the House. Rush Limbaugh came out against it recently. Now, Paul Ryan is going to try to take this slavery language out when he goes to the House floor. That's going to be tricky, you know.
Because Democrats are going to want that. Slavery. And there's only maybe about 18 Democrats that have said, okay, they'll flip and vote for fast track. But the majority of the Democrats in the House are saying, we're going to stay united and not vote for this. So, yeah, Boehner and Kevin McCarthy and Scalise have to get as many Republicans as they can. And it isn't looking good. And people within the more conservative faction it's coming down to them saying, well, you know, Obama's never come down here and really talked to us. He doesn't have capital down here. Some of it just comes down to not even trade, but down to, we don't want to be seen as aligning ourselves next to this president, so we're not going to.
Yeah, I mean, they've been saying for years that he illegally oversteps his authority, and now they're going to have to try to explain to their constituents why they voted to give him more authority to cut a trade deal with, like, the United Nations One World Government or something like that.
Right. It would be pretty cool, I think, if there was, like, say, some nation that stood up and said, we're not going to let you get away with that.
Anyway. It would be... That'd be
kind of cool, wouldn't it?
The best turn of events would be that if Canada, which is a party to the TPP, because it has a little Pacific border there, said, look, the United States is 70th. Ranked 70th in its labor protections and labor rights that it affords its own workers. And we're not going to participate in any TPP that allows a serial abuser like the United States to be a part of it. And they need to up their game. Then all of a sudden, maybe Elizabeth Warren and Sherrod Brown and those folks might actually be for a sovereignty, a facing trade deal if it actually got us closer to the labor protections that a place like Canada has.
Might be. So we're all basically counting on Canada to sort this out.
Yeah, I guess so.
Sounds pretty depressing, guys. We're going to be... Where does this go from here?
So
besides the House of Representatives.
Well, after the House passes it, which they likely will...
Think it definitely still passes the House?
The fast track, I think that they're going to find a way to. I mean, they're not going to leave.
They can't.
Yeah, they...
I think it won't.
You don't think fast track will pass the House?
Ooh.
I think it will.
Do we have a little wager, maybe?
Bet you a Diet Coke.
Right. Coffee. Well,
all right.
Okay, if caffeine will be freely exchanged between our two panelists, depending on how this vote goes.
Clarify my prediction. I think it'll happen, but not under this president. I think the next president will get it through.
Really?
Whoever he or she is. Yeah.
Why do you think it's going to take that long?
I mean, if it doesn't happen now, then it can't happen until...
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
I see what you're saying. Yeah, okay. So this is Obama's one bite at this apple, is what you're saying.
Mm-hmm. I don't see how he gets it done in 2016 if he can't get it done now.
Yeah, good point. Good point.
Yeah, right. I agree with that, but I think it'll happen.
All right, well, we end on a sort of semi-fun note that someone will either lose a coffee or a Diet Coke. But we'll return to the story as we know more. In the meantime... sorry to everyone who is being human trafficked, because apparently we're not going to do anything about it.
For now.
And tell the people where they can follow you on Twitter.
You can follow me at L. Barone Lopez.
That's LBARRONLOPEZ.
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah.
And I'm at Ryan Grimm.
With one M.
With one M.
But people make that mistake a lot.
Yeah, they do.
You're Grimm like the disposition.
Exactly.
Not Grimm like Michael Grimm, the guy who threatens reporters.
Right.
Oh my God.
Thanks very much, guys.
Thank you.
So that's what happened this week. This podcast was produced and edited by Ibrahim Balki, with technical direction from Brad Shannon and assistance from Christine Canetta and Adriana Usero. I'm Jason Linkins. This week, we were joined by Huffington Post reporters Zach Carter, Arthur Delaney, Ryan Grimm, and Laura Barone-Lopez. So That Happened is available on iTunes. Check us out in the iTunes store and look for the Huffington Post whole family of podcasts. Please subscribe and tell your friends. If there's something you'd like to hear us talk about, send an email to sothathappened@huffingtonpost.com. As always, thanks for listening, and we miss you already.